Thank you for having me here. Thank you, Lael, and thank you, Kara Noble, as well. Both of you have been wonderful. And thank you, Raphael, for reading my political blog and deciding that maybe I had something to say also about music. I'm going to talk to you about this. And I wrote a couple of things, and I'll kind of read them and go around. Walter Pater once said that all art constantly aspires towards the condition of music. And basically what he means is something having to do with the abstract nature of music is something that all art tends to aspire to, at least in Mr. Pater's opinion. But one thing that's true today is that all the arts today, especially music, apparently aspire to the condition of science. Music, for over 1,000 years, has been characterized almost as mathematics and sound. Boethius, in the Middle Ages, called music sounding numbers, and Pythagoras probably said that hundreds of years before as well. And the relationship between music and math and music and the sciences is something that's basically considered a given. And in contemporary music, in modern concert classical music, I should say, rather than contemporary music, because that's a large field, many of us consider ourselves research scientists. And one of the most typical ones is a fellow by the name of Milton Babbitt, who many of you who have studied music or know music or love contemporary music have heard of. And Babbitt once said in 1958, the time has passed, he's talking about the contemporary, about modern music writing. The time has passed when the normally well-educated man, he also means women, without special preparation could understand the most advanced work in it, for example, mathematics, philosophy, and physics. A double standard is invoked, however, with the words music is music, implying also that music is just music. Why not then equate the activities of the radio repairman with those of the theoretical physicist on the basis of the dictum that physics is just physics? It is not difficult to find statements like the following from the New York Times of September 8, 1957. The scientific level of the conference is so high that there are, in the words of only 120 mathematicians specializing in the field who could contribute. Specialized music, on the other hand, far from signifying height of musical level, has been charged with decadence, even as evidence of insidious conspiracy. So this is clearly a fellow who believes that basically music is a branch of science, is in fact science. But is modern music making really analogous to some kind of science? Well, that's a question which I can't answer, but what I'm going to do is to show you a little bit about what I do, talk a little bit about the concerns that seem to interact with science, and let you make up your own mind. I thought a lot about my own relationship to science, and basically here is how I'll be using it. But there are other things that I won't be discussing, such as research into how music affects us. If you're interested in that, there's a wonderful book by Daniel Levitin called This Is Your Brain on Music that begins to explain some of the research there. In fact, when I was a kid and I was at Columbia, I studied with Tom Bever, who had done some of the early research on right brain, left brain, and how when you learn music, apparently you switch hemispheres. And of course, the story is much more complicated than that. And ultimately, as a composer, I have only one practical interest in this research, which is what can I steal from it and use? And I found that there were other aspects of science that I could steal much more profitably from than that. So I won't be talking about it, but if you're interested, that's a great thing to do. Basically, I'm going to walk you through a couple of things. First of all is what a musical experiment is, what the technology that we use is, because basically what we do in terms of where we intersect mostly with science is in terms of our technology, and I'll show you an amazing video to give you an idea of how far it is. It blows my mind, and I've been doing, it's hard to impress when you've been involved in the technology of music since basically 1967. Science's metaphor is a very important thing in music, far more important than I think many people realize. And finally, science is subject matter, which is actually very rare, surprisingly so. And to that end, I'm going to be playing you excerpts from my latest piece, The Origin. But before I do that, I figured I should really establish some credibility and give you an idea of my piece, Voices of Light, which, as Blair explained, premiered at the Academy of Music in Northampton. This particular thing within, I have all this animation of the PowerPoint, you'll have to excuse it. This is taken at a rehearsal at the Sydney Opera House. Trust me, if you are a composer, you want your music played at the Sydney Opera House. It's an amazing place, and it was an extraordinary performance. This is another place where you want your music played, the Academy of Music at Northampton, Mass. This is in February of 94 with the original performers, Megger, Winbrand, and conducting. Basically, Voices of Light is inspired by and accompanies a film about Joan of Arc. All the texts are taken from the writings of medieval female mystics of the period, and the film is a very great silent film by Carl Theodor Dreyer. At the time that I did it, it was virtually unknown, and I was very interested in the subject matter for reasons that I'll explain later, and I decided to write a piece about it. I'm going to play you one movement from it, and I have to switch, do a little bit of a switch here, and I'm going to play you the torture music. Don't worry, if you faint of heart, nobody gets hurt. But it gives you some indication of the kinds of projects that I do when I do large projects. And if you're interested, I can talk about the technologies and behind this as well. But in any case, here's the piece.
Thank you.
That's a little bit from one of my completed pieces, and I figured because of the connection here to Northampton, it would be kind of interesting for you to serve as an introduction to my work. Getting back to the subject of science, the first thing I wanted to discuss was the notion of experimentation. I don't have any insight into how scientists conduct experiments, and I'm not sure I even have any genuine insight into how all composers conduct the experiments, but I know that we all do. And I thought that what I would do is I would discuss basically mine and then give you a comparison or at least some introduction to the fact that others do this as well. The notion of the composer as the mad scientist, the poster child for that is none other than Edgar Varèse, who was quite a figure. By the way, that's an excerpt from his piece, Hyperprism. And this is Varèse. He was a basically middle 20th century composer. Most of his most famous works were done in the 1920s and 30s, except for some stunning pieces in the 50s and early 60s. Some other pictures of Varèse, quite an extraordinarily striking man. Even as an old man, he looked like a mad scientist. And he kept on looking like a mad scientist, and there he is again. Well, that isn't Varèse, but you know, it could have been. Anyway, Varèse wrote a piece called Poème Électronique, and as you can see from this, clearly that doesn't look anything like music, except maybe at the bottom. You get the idea that this is a fellow who, if anybody, this is the final score to Poème Électronique, and I'll play you some of it. I'm not sure if it's exactly that part, but gives you some indication of what Varèse's music sounds like. Well, I'm sorry it was a little quiet, but you get the idea. If anything could be considered experimental music, that would be it. But that's not what Varèse felt about his music. My experiments end up in the wastebasket. Afterwards, it is the listener who must experiment. And what Varèse is calling your attention to is the fact that a finished piece of music is primarily an aesthetic experience. It's not an intellectual experience per se. It's not a learning experience. It's an artistic experience, which is something completely different. But if a work like Poème Électronique, the last piece that you heard, is not an experiment, then what really does a musical experiment sound like? And that's what I'm going to show you, at least in my own work. And this is a simple musical experiment. You're going to hear some reconstructions that my assistant and I did, and then you'll hear the final experiment. This is a little phrase. That's it, the phrase. What does it mean? What does the phrase mean? Well, if you listen to it, it maybe is kind of a lovely, kind of a sad, kind of a plangent little harp phrase. But if you actually look at the structure, it's a palindrome, but it's a very special kind of palindrome. It's a metrical palindrome. It's a bar of 2/8 followed by a bar of 3/8 followed by a bar of 4/8 with a middle bar of 5/8 and then 4/8, 3/8, 2/8 on the other end. And I couldn't resist, sorry. You get the idea. Okay, so listen to it again, slowly. Okay. I was really curious about this, God knows why. Actually, I do know why, and I'll show you why a little bit later. But what I decided to do was figure out, after I wrote the phrase, I thought, oh, that's kind of a cool phrase. Now, what happens if I put it on top of itself, but shift it over by one bar? So you have a palindrome in Canada that is a palindrome with the row, row, row your boat technique. Okay? So basically, a second harp is going to come in a second, in this example. Second harp comes in down there, but it comes in one bar later. But it's the same thing, just shifted over a bar and flipped around on itself. Now what happens? Let's take a listen to that, and I think that this one is a little bit faster, up to pretty close to actual tempo. It'll repeat twice, then it'll go down, and then it'll double on itself. Was kind of cool. Okay, suddenly you get all these like really, really nifty counter melodies from it. Okay, well, what happens if you do that like three times, put another one there, and then a fourth one? And then what happens if you keep on rotating them and rotating them, and then you shift notes around and everything? And so in 1992, I wrote a piece, this with a different sound, an old DX7 harp sound, and I just wanted to give you an idea of all the amazing little melodies that come out of this incredibly simple experiment that I was doing with just a simple metrical palindrome. Some composers have built entire careers doing experiments like that, and all the more power to them. These are only one kind of experiment. In terms of my own music, I just thought I'd give you an idea of where I came up with that idea. Okay, this is a piece called The Silence, which is for double string quartet, performed here by the Sirius String Quartet playing on top of themselves, i.e. via recording. And I'll play you an example of that piece, and it'll stop just at the point where I started to get the idea for that experiment. Okay. See? Okay, so the way that entire section kind of comes to a kind of a crunchy rhythmical climax is through that additive thing of going 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, well, I figured, well, if you do that, why not go 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, you know, and so on. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool. And then develop more things and more ideas for other pieces. But we can trace that even back further to this piece called Maxwell's Demon. All the physicists in the audience know exactly what I mean by Maxwell's Demon. And everybody else, of course, knows that it comes up in a Thomas Pynchon novel. This is a piece for solo electric violin. This is the score. And if you look at the first bar, those of you who can read music will recognize a very, very simple rhythm. It's an old drum machine rhythm, or actually rock drum rhythm. Boom, chop, ba-bum, bum, chop, boom. Okay? Very, very simple rhythm. It was experimenting with those rhythms that ultimately led to the last piece. This piece sounds like this. It answers the age-old musical question, what would an electric violin sound like if it was really a drum machine? For a very simple reason. There's no harpist alive who could actually play that. It's actually a bar of 23/8. And to play that and to play something that precisely to create all those complicated counterrhythms, I think would be virtually impossible. So for me, it was a conceptual experiment. Each one of these pieces has layers and layers of those kinds of testing out and trying out. Earlier at the conference, we were talking about play and experimentation. And to call all this testing out play is a little, I think, unfair to the level at which composers do this. To call it experimenting, though, may be, I'll admit, a little pompous and pretentious. But whatever it is, I'm not the only one who does it. This fellow does it as well. His name is Ludwig von Beethoven. He's a pretty darn good composer. And I want to show you something. This here is one bar from the final manuscript. The final manuscript, okay, not a sketch, of Opus 69, Cello Sonata, first movement, bar 65. That is what he sent to the copyist to get copies. Okay? Now, as crazy as that is, there's somebody even crazier. Namely, this guy, Lewis Lockwood. In this book, Beethoven Studies in the Creative Process, he actually studied that bar and figured out all the layers of experimentation that Beethoven did to get that bar right. This is the first thing he wrote down, okay? Then he crossed that out, that's what those hatches mean, and then he wrote that other stuff. Then he didn't like that. So then they crossed that out, and then he wrote that, and then he didn't like that. And he finally ended up with that, okay? Everything that doesn't have the wedges around it is what he ended up with, and it looks like that. Okay, now those of you who read music, you know, should be amused. For those of you who don't, here's what it sounds like. That's it. That's the whole thing. Okay, that's what all that experimenting led to. And to give you an indication of the level and the amount of work, and this relates to what we were talking about earlier about creativity, okay, here is the complete page of that, again, final manuscript of Opus 69. Okay? And that's where that part came from. Look at all the other stuff that Beethoven was doing. And that's not only one page. Here's another page from the same piece. Okay, when we talk about creativity, we keep on forgetting what Edison used to say, which is that creativity is what? 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. That's basically what goes on with all of us when we compose music. Beethoven was a little bit more, expressive in his experimentation and let more of it leak out in a certain sort of way to the people down the road. But that's what all of us do. This fellow also was a hell of an experimenter. Completely different style of experimentation than Beethoven. Where Beethoven basically did a technique which Bob Dylan calls vomitation, i.e. write everything out and then choose. Okay, Bach was more systematic about it. It's a great idea. All of us should do, that's what we all do, at least that's one of the things that I do. You write down every idea. It takes a genius like Dylan to come up with a great name for it. But anyway, Bach had all these groovy ways of experimenting. This is a wonderful book, Lawrence Dreyfus, Bach and the Patterns of Invention. And he goes down and he codifies each one of these things that Bach would almost systematically do when he was investigating the material that he came up with a piece. He'd write an idea down, whatever the idea was. It could be, a very, very simple idea. And then he would almost systematically check if he could array it, if he could canonize it, how to decorate it, what its definition, musical definition was, how to invert it, whatever the hell a left branch is, I don't know. Which brings up another issue. This book was written in 96, when computers kind of like finally filtered down to the kind of people whose musical curiosity ends with Johann Sebastian Bach. And so at that time, this was really hip language, right? This was the language of computer algorithms. So he applied it, of course, to Bach. Bach, of course, never used this language. But it gives you some indication of the way that music uses science and scientific ideas. They use them as tropes, basically. They use them as metaphors. But we rarely ever use real science. That's a very, it's a very interesting thing. There's actually very little science by the time you get to the level where you have to put together a piece of music. But we do tend to use it metaphorically. Before I talk more about that, which I'll talk about practically in terms of the piece, I thought I'd go through music technology. And I want to say that I have a love-hate relationship with music technology and with technology in general. And it's best illustrated this way. I need some props. Okay. First prop I have is a very ancient technology. It's called a piece of paper. Okay. You don't think of this as a technology, but it's fairly sophisticated. Okay? The reason for it, although it has its problems, the main problem that it has is that it can only hold a little bit of music in it. This is a hard drive, okay? This is what we think of when we think of as technology, okay? This is an amazingly sophisticated device. It holds this thing, this hard drive that I have, I'll take it out of its protective wrapping. This hard drive that I have contains all the music that I've ever written. Every single file is on here. And all I need to do is to take this cord and plug it into my computer, and I can give you all the music that I ever have. Let me do that for you. Oh no. I'm really sorry. I brought the wrong cord. Oh no. Now, which is the more sophisticated technology? Okay, that's my point. There's a lot of that. I could spend an entire lecture, and believe me, you don't want to hear it, about sampling rates and how insane sampling, digital audio sampling rates are, let alone word clock, which is an even more obsessive topic of mine, but you don't want to hear it. Our technology is very primitive, our musical technology. Basically, it's at the level that the piano was in its development in the 13th century, which means that we don't even know what good musical technology looks like. But nevertheless, we can do some amazing things, as you'll see. The most important musical technology, the most profound musical technology, is this one. Sound reproduction. It literally transforms society in ways that I don't think that anybody has yet completely understood. At the time, before sound reproduction, music was something that the elites or the middle class controlled. After that, a man named McKinley Morganfield, a dirt poor farmer, a black farmer in nowhere, Mississippi, later became Muddy Waters and became one of the most famous and most influential musicians in the world. Music, sound reproduction technology literally transformed the world. Unfortunately, I don't have enough time to talk about it in the way that I would, so off he goes. And what I did want to talk to you a little bit about is composition technology and give you an idea of how it's developed very, very quickly. This is around an early synthesizer, music synthesizer, and that's our friend Milton Bavin. Looking very scientific there. He looks like he came out of the Los Alamos or something, you know, with gadgets. Over on the far left is a teletype machine where he would punch in holes and then he'd run through by hand, literally a player piano sort of thing, and that whole thing would make boops and beeps and create all sorts of funny noises. And Milton spent a good deal of his career doing these absolutely amazing pieces. One of the amazing things, the interesting things about Babbitt is that if you read what he says, if you take the trouble to read what he says, you hate him. But if you listen to his music, he's a wonderful composer. And it should give you a lesson that you should never trust what a composer says about his own work. Okay, moving on. Okay, this is early on, this is 1970. This was, I'm going to give you a history of music technology through the stuff that I got involved in and to the extent that I was able to document with pictures. In 1967, I formed with the other characters in this picture a multimedia group. We were all in high school, and in fact, the kid in the middle became a professor of geophysics at University of Illinois, and the kid second from the left was already losing his hair at 17. And We did pieces, and this is the manual from the first tape recorder that I used. I started out doing electronic music, and I found these on the internet, and I was just flabbergasted to find it. That's the manual that I learned how to record from. And I did an early piece. This is an excerpt from a four-channel piece I wrote in 1971 by literally taking sounds, distorting them with tape recorders, and synchronizing two tape recorders together. And I came up with this. Was listening to Perez. And in fact, that served as my audition piece for Columbia University. I played that with Vladimir Suchetsky, who was the head of the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Center, and he encouraged me to apply, and I owe him a lot. And here is a picture in the early 70s of Columbia University with and what it looked like. Just for you music tech nerds, I'm just going to show you some of the technology. All of it's totally obsolete. Sine wave generators, analog tape recorders, don't have them anymore. A Buchla 200 music synthesizer, an amazing device. And they actually built, custom-built rotary pots. And for those of you who know, that's an outrageous thing to have built back then. It had already long gone beyond that. I gravitated to this gadget, which is an early synthesizer in a box. Remember that big room that Milton had? You could then buy, by the early to mid 70s, you could buy one of these boxes like that and have a whole, basically have that room in a box that you could lug around, and that became fairly famous. Pete Townsend of the Who used it. Edgar Winter used it and became a rather famous gadget. And today, they're so rare and they're so prized that they're worth more than what I paid for. They're worth around $4,500, $5,000 if you can even find them. The next big revolution in terms of music tech was musical instrument digital interface, MIDI. Without MIDI, most of the music that you know, most of the pop music you know, wouldn't have been useful. MIDI is basically, it's nothing. It's just a protocol. It's just a way of getting gadgets to talk to each other. Say you have a DX7, okay, which is an early MIDI synthesizer. The problem was, supposing you want to play another synthesizer at the same time because you can only have one sound. So you'd stack synthesizers on top and then you'd play it like that. What MIDI allowed you to do was to hook up that synthesizer to another synthesizer, like this, and then you could use the top synthesizer to play the electronics of the bottom synthesizer. Pretty neat. Matter of fact, it was so neat that there was an explosion of sales of musical instruments as a result. But very quickly, people realized, why stop there? Why not have a whole bunch of MIDI gadgets, you can see them all the way on the left, hook them up to a computer, hook them up with some synthesizers that are being emulated inside a computer, hook them all up, have some software to control the whole bloody thing, and you can literally have an orchestra in your home, and you can have, you can literally compose music, literally write dots on the screen and have all these instruments play. It's amazing. And basically, that's what happened in the 80s, and that's the way almost all of us of a certain age and lower compose these days. Very few people that I know are writing music solely on the piano. Most of us are somehow or another incorporating MIDI. This gives you an idea of the home studio around 97, a few years after Voices of Light was written. And again, for you music nerds, and again, stuff has shrunk. and things have changed. And this will give you, there's a MIDI synthesizer. It's shrunk from one of those big units just simply to a rack unit. And to make things even more amazing, you could hook up 240 channels. That's what we were doing. This MIDI interface is now obsolete because we've moved beyond external MIDI devices. But yeah, the idea was you got as many gadgets as you could. You know, your whole studio was filled with little boxes. And in fact, a lot of those boxes were digital samplers. We got away from doing exclusively electronic sounds to recording sounds, then manipulating them and literally simulating an orchestra with actual recordings of orchestral sounds. And finally, thank God, I got a mixer with linear faders. Okay. This was my portable studio when I went away to an artist colony. All the power of all those other instruments, and then some, is contained in this tiny little rig. High quality portable monitor system, portable digital audio interface, a tiny little audio recorder, keyboard, of course, you see, grand piano, and the most important piece of technology that I own, the Moleskine music notebook, without which I never go without. I have one here on me somewhere, or I took it out of my pocket. Really, really great thing to have if you're a composer. This is my studio at home. You'll notice a certain visage up there in the background. And this is typical stuff. It's shrunk to just simply some active near-field monitors, three Macs networked off camera, and an auxiliary video monitor, and that's it. Speaker stands with ISO pads, make it sound professional, and an artist sketch pad, and I literally write my staves in by hand with a music pen. I like dirty. Dirty's better. And this is the software that I use. And if you find that intimidating, you're not the only one. So do I. You wouldn't even know that it was music software if it wasn't for the stuff in the middle. This software is amazing. It's also unbelievably clunky and bug-ridden, and you can't live without it. Now, I don't want to leave you with the idea that music tech is particularly. I want to dazzle you for a moment, and I'm sorry I'm going a little behind, but I think that probably this is worth seeing anyway. This is currently in beta, and it's a little video of this fellow, Peter Neubacher, explaining something truly astonishing. I think you'll get a kick out of it.
See, this is a normal sound file being shown in a pretty usual style. Let's listen to it. And so on. So this is a Spanish guitar played live. And what you could already do with Melodyne before was to slowly ride through the sound, listening precisely to what's going on. As you can hear, you have to deal with chords here, which are blending into each other. But if you wanted to know what is exactly going on at this point, what is happening inside the chord, you would need to spread it up, to look inside, just like viewing a piano roll or any other kind of abstract notation or so. And this is exactly what happens when you decide to separate the notes. Every note can be seen at exactly the place where it was played. Let's play it once again. You see, every note is actually there. Each of these things we call blobs stands for a note, and I can grab it and move it. Or I could turn its volume up or down. I'll just let this passage play for a while. Back or forth in time. I can totally redesign the melody. Or I can retune the whole thing by using special macro functions. Here the system analyzed the harmony of this passage as being A minor. Let's take a longer passage, and while it plays, we switch on the fly to another key. Since this part has been analyzed, the sound of every note can be extracted, and I can freely manipulate any single note inside.
That to me is absolutely mind-blowing. It's not out yet, but you should be able to find it fairly soon. I want to introduce you to the origin, or what I'm calling science is subject for music. Couldn't resist that little effect. Basically, oddly enough, science is rarely used as a subject for music. In fact, my assistant found this little chart, and it shows mentions of music plus science by century. And you can see that up until the 20th century, there really haven't been too many. And in the 21st century, actually, it even shot up far more than that. In fact, maybe some musicologists know of this, but I can't think of a single piece from the age of Newton which celebrates Newton, or from Darwin's time that celebrates Darwin, or Pasteur, or anybody like that. The notion of music as of science as a subject matter is actually a 20th century idea. And I wrote this piece called The Origin, which is based on Charles Darwin's work. I got interested in science, and particularly in evolution, around the same time as I did in music. I saw Inherit the Wind, and that got me interested in the Scopes monkey trial, which is one of the famous evolution creationism things. That's William Jennings Bryan at the actual trial. And this is John T. Scopes. He published his autobiography in 1967, and I read it and became a lifelong fan of and very curious very interested in both evolutionary biology and also in the social controversy, which is a whole other can of worms. Now, this is a strange chart, which gives you some indication of why I felt a moral incentive to do a piece on Darwin. Belief that evolution is true by country. At the top are the countries, and the blue line represents the top, the most people, the most percentage of a country that believes in evolution. Where's the United States? Well, you keep on going, and you keep on going, and you keep on going, and we beat Turkey. Yeah, so we should really feel comfortable about that. That gives you some indication of how pathetic our understanding of science is in this country. This, believe it or not, is what got me focused on the piece. These are the sketchbooks, evolution sketchbooks that Darwin did. These are the opening covers for it. They were on display at the Museum of Natural History, I don't know, around 2005 or 2006, and I suddenly realized now I know what the piece I'm going to do on evolution is going to be about. It's going to be about these sketchbooks and about the making of the origin, or if you'd like, the origin of the origin. And here's the title page for it, and when you start to think about it for a while, you instantly come up with The Creation, if you're a musician. That's a very famous piece by Haydn. And of course, that's it. I hesitate to put this slide together because I'm not in any way comparing the quality of the pieces. I mean, Haydn's a master composer, and I'm a piker. But what I was doing was I wanted to respond to The Creation by doing The Origin. It's one of the many in-jokes in the piece. And this is the sketch that made me realize that I was on the right track. This is the famous, I think it's 1838, sketch from Darwin's notebook. And that drawing over there is the first drawing of the tree of life, of evolutionary branching. And check out what he writes at the top, I think. Now, if you're a musician, and you have pieces like the creation in your head, there's only that should give you a sense of the contrast with credo in Unum Deum from the Mass. Credo, I believe. The contrast between I think as a worldview versus I believe as a worldview. That's when I realized I had enough metaphorical ammo to write yet an evening-long piece, you know, that I could really start to find these kinds of interesting and exciting kinds of juxtapositions. Let's see. Now, here's, you think that that's Charles Darwin. That is Charles Darwin, but that's not the guy who wrote The Origin of Species. That's an old man. That's a guy who's ill, who is looking back on his life. The man who wrote The Origin of Species was this guy. Actually, he was a few years younger when he discovered when he put together and realized the principles that became evolution by natural selection. But when you have this guy in your head, and you think, and you know that that's the guy who wrote, who really wrote The Origin of Species, how do you express that musically? Well, you want to get as far away from, the upper class bit of British twit as you can. And so I used, to portray Charles Darwin, I used this bunch of female Bulgarian singers, it's a Bulgarian choir, to portray the character Charles Darwin, which we premiered 2 days before the Darwin Bicentennial in February. And to give you an indication of what their music sounds like, I thought I would give you, they actually portray the man Charles Darwin. And Charles Darwin loved Beatles. He loved Beatles. This is a friend of his who drew these goofy sketches of Charlie riding a Beatle because he loved him so much. And I thought I would play you some of the music. All the words you're going to hear are taken from Charles's autobiography.
One day I saw two red beetles and seized one in each hand. Then I saw a third and new kind, which I could not bear to lose. A taste for collecting beetles, a taste for collecting beetles, it is some indication of future success in life. So I caught the one I held in my right hand, came to my mouth. Alas, it ejected some intensely accurate fluid, which burnt my tongue, burnt my tongue. A taste for collecting beetles, a taste for collecting beetles, is some indication of future success in life.
I was forced to spit the beetle out, which was lost, which was lost, which was lost. I was forced to spit the beetle out, which was lost, which was lost, which was lost.
A taste for collecting beetles, a taste for collecting beetles, it is some indication of future success in life.
I went out collecting without way of Trinity, also with a strong son, member of Parliament.
If I can indulge you, there is one more piece that I would like to play for you. Is that okay? Can I play one more? Okay, great. I'm going to skip right to the science's metaphor, or rather, science as a topic. And this is a piece called A Great Tree, which is kind of like the ultimate, the main metaphor, the main simile that Darwin uses. And this is written for orchestra, chorus, and solos. And it also has a fantastic film by Bill Morrison, who's an avant-garde filmmaker. I commissioned the films from him. And it gives you some indication of the chorus and the soloist represent, if Darwin, the man, the human being, is represented by a female Bulgarian choir, Darwin's theories are represented and are sung in contrast to, say, the doxology or some sort of liturgical dogma. His theories are sung by chorus and soloists. And here's an indication of what that looks and sounds like. Chance to turn this up.